Please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Tonight, our 40-minute speaker is Bobby D. from Irvine.
Oh, cool, there's a clock. I'm Bobby, I'm an alcoholic. I'm clear up something so I get some street cred here in San Clemente. I was from Irvine, and my wife and I just moved down here in June, so I am now Bobby from San Clemente, which is cool. So we like being here. I want to congratulate Brittany for being the leader tonight and a newcomer. I think that's really cool. And I remember being a newcomer. I don't think I could have done what she's doing tonight. And you're doing a great job, Brittany. Thank you. I want to welcome the newcomers, too, and say that, you know, for me, the deal for me tonight was more like, you know, I hope I say something that you can identify with. Because, I don't know, for me, identifying as an alcoholic with alcoholics was very big in my, my early days of getting sober. And, you know, I was able to do that. I've been sober. I got sober September 16th, 1987, and haven't drank since then. And, you know, part of that was, again, identifying with alcoholics and Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's a cool thing. I also want to suggest that, you know, you guys can go out here tonight and you never have to drink again if you don't want to. That's been the case for me by just attending these meetings and doing what people suggest and stuff like that. You know, I... water, cool. I supposed to be what, you know, what was like, what happened, and what it's like now, and stuff like that. That's a big room. A lot of people here. There wasn't that many people when I sat down. I grew up in the mean streets of Brentwood, California, which is it's a nice little suburb in West LA. I'm the youngest of four kids. I'm the youngest. I have an older sister, two older brothers. My father was a doctor. He was blessed with surgeon hands. He was a heart surgeon. A wonderful guy. He did a lot with that gift. He was a great man. So my mother was the DI at home, trying to keep track of four kids and run a house. And we lived well. It was a nice neighborhood. I didn't want for anything per se. We weren't. You know, my dad was way cool about, he wasn't extravagant enough. We had a nice life. You know, I have no reason to, wasn't why I became an alcoholic. But I did do know that I felt weird from the get-go. And I think I was just weird coming out the chute. Bypassed the information booth and just landed in this land of weird, you know. And I didn't know that, you know. I didn't know how really weird I was until I had my first drink, and then I had something to relate to. But until then, it was I didn't know till hindsight, till I had, after that first drink, did I really feel, you know, the difference of what it was like to be what I felt when I had that first drink was normal or something like that. I was you know, in hindsight, paranoid, insecure, self-centered, you know, fearful of everything, and, you know, totally self-conscious, you know, as a kid. I didn't know that, but that's how I existed. Then, you know, fortunately, my older brother thought it would be a good idea to get his little younger brother drunk. And, you know, it's getting close to being like 50 years ago. And the reason I say that is, you know, I can barely remember what I had for breakfast, you know. But I can remember exactly what happened, exactly what happened when he gave me that drink. I can remember the room exactly. I can remember, you know, the carpet, the couch I was sitting on, record player over there. That's one of the, most of you guys don't know what those are. There's big black vinyl things. There's a Victrola, you know, with a dog and shit. You know. Way cool. Scratchy. You know, it was like Eminem tried to be, really cool. And this cool French windows and this bar that just sparkled. And you know, he gave me a vodka and 7-Up, I think. It was vodka, I know that. I don't know what he put in it. You know, when I took that first chug, it was like my body had been waiting for that for 10 years. It just went zoom. I mean, it was like I was electrified. And instantaneously. And it didn't, I heard a lot of people say it, you know, made you feel taller and bigger and funnier and crap like that. And that's cool. You know, I have no problem with that. All it did, you know, it did for me is it lifted me up to normal, if that makes sense. It lifted me up to being okay, and it lifted me up to being equal with my brother, you know, which was way cool, because I always felt less than, you know, I always felt, and all those things just, you know, all of a sudden this flash back and forth of, wow, this is cool, wow, and knowing what was happening, you know, and the different feeling. I also blacked out that night too. I drank so much, after the first drink, apparently somewhere I blacked out. I can tell you up to the point of excitement and electricity and magic, somewhere after that point I lose my memory. But after 50 years, it's pretty good. Somewhere, you know, I blacked out that night, and I was told the next day that my brother, who's actually much bigger than I am, but he said he was impressed with my tenacity to get more alcohol after the first drink. And, you know, he said it was interesting to watch you clamber back to that bar. And, you know, and the other thing was interesting, I thought, too, was, and thinking back, was that apparently it was obvious that Bobby had gotten drunk. And nobody said anything. I thought that was kind of weird. It was like, you know, I figured Mom might say something, Dad might say something. Nobody said anything. It's kind of weird. But all that, and what that gave me, you know, I didn't become a daily drinker, obviously, but, you know, what that gave me was a zone, a place, something I could go to, something I could hold on to when I was uncomfortable, which was most of the time. You know, I can, if you drank anything like I did in further on in my drinking career, and there were times when you were really thirsty, and you'd go to the liquor store, and you're waiting to get that bottle of whatever you're drinking, and the guy, you give him your money, and he gives you to it in a bag. That feeling when you get it in the bag is like, almost, wow, I'm almost there. You know what I mean? That feeling you're almost there. That's what alcohol gave me at a young age, even though I didn't drink every day. You know, I could be in school and go, you know, daydream. Ah, there is a place I can go, you know, and or in a function, you know, I had to go to dance in school and shit like that, and I just scared me to death. But you know, I still got through all that by having this little thing. And we were Catholic, went to a Catholic school, which I don't blame too much on. I was raised Catholic, and I went to a Catholic school, which meant that we did a lot of parties at our house, celebrating saints' days and things like that. So that was an occasion to drink some wine, or grab a pull off my dad's old fashioned, or you know, grab and pull off some beers and stuff like that. Over, you know, progressively getting more and more as I grew up. But you know, the problem, you know, for me was it was a constant battle to kind of fit in, you know, and it's just crazy. I don't blame the Catholic school for anything except for, you know, this may sound silly, but I think the only reason I tell this is because it's kind of where I have started having dilemmas in my life at a very young age. And one of the first dilemmas was brought on by Sister Carmel Mary in my second grade class, which was very, you know, right around Christmas time, she started mentioning that Christmas was about Jesus Christ's birthday, you know, and immediately I had this dilemma that I had all these presents at home under the tree, you know, and there was a Santa Claus guy that brought more, and immediately my mind's going, I got to play both sides of the street here, you know, I got to make Sister Carmel Mary happy, but I sure as heck aren't going to tell my parents about this Jesus thing, because, you know, I don't want them to take all those presents away. And I don't know, you know, I'm second grade, and I'm already playing each angle and playing the game, and, you know, I'm not sure I was a normal kid, you know what I mean? And so anyway, that was my first dilemma, and, you know, I went on, boom, you know, I went through that grammar school, and I did pretty well. It was the best education I had. In those days, when you finish this Catholic school thing, what you did is you took a test to go to another Catholic high school, and there was two Catholic schools that our school went to. It was either St. Monica's or Loyola, both very nice schools up in L.A. And the problem was the best school to go to at that time was Loyola, and that's the one I was going to go take a test for, except that my brother had gone there, my older brother, and they dismissed him because of his behavioral problems, he picked a fight with one of the brothers, basically. And they said, Dr. Davis, we don't want any more Davis kids at this school. They thought that was kind of interesting. So my brothers blazed a trail, which was hard to follow. So I got into this Catholic high school, St. Monica's, by taking a test. And for some reason, this is kind of like where my life took a turn, was that for some reason, at that time, my parents, I think, had become tired of raising kids. They became tired of the school thing. They became tired they were just tired, man. They were exhausted. My three siblings just, you know, put them through the ringer. And they asked me, they said, do you want to go to this Catholic high school, which is down a little bit farther away, or you want to go down to this junior high school, which is a skateboard down the hill ride to school, which were most of my friends were going that I liked, most of the loser crowd or whatever, the fun crowd. So, you know, they gave me the choice, you know. So where'd I go? You know, I skateboarded to junior high school and skateboarded right on through that school and skateboarded right on through high school because mainly the education was boring after grammar, after that Catholic school. They taught me everything I needed to know. And so school lost interest real quick. The stuff they were studying in public school was stuff I was doing in the third grade. I'm not dissing the public schools, but it's just the way it was. So school became less of a challenge, and partying, and I liked sports. I did like sports. So drinking was cool, and it was a social lubricant, and sports was cool too. That's what I liked to do. That got me through. And junior high school was also where I met my wife, actually. I met her, and it was need at first sight. She was a child of an alcoholic, and I was an alcoholic in the making. So we just knit, you know, we just saw each other, and we just glommed onto each other. And so at first it was need, and then it grew into love, and she stuck with me when it started going down. But I zipped on through high school, and again, as I mentioned, I was the youngest, and my dad had high hopes for me. I was going to be the one, you know. My sister, she went to a 2-year school and got married at a young age. Made him a grandfather quick. My two older brothers, like I said, they were a pretty hard act to follow, but they weren't much of scholar students. So my father had high hopes for me. I did get good grades and all that crap. And so it came down to choosing schools and what I was going to do. And I made the hard choice and became a professional sailor, which was a little bit different than going to med school. but surprised him a little bit, and it was a different challenge, I will say, you know, to become a professional sailor and then going to med school. But, you know, I'll give the old man credit. You know, he said, he always said, if you ever want to go back to school, I'll be here for you, you know. And I never did, but it was nice of him to say that. So I zipped on through my sailing days. I got married in there somewhere. You know, I'm over 21 about now, and alcohol has been a pretty big part of my life. And, you know, I got married in there. Vicky and I got married. And getting married was pressure. You know what I mean? It was like, oh, man. You know, and she was really down on my sailing thing. She didn't like me being, going away all the time. And that kind of bummed me out. But, you know, she said, let's try and find something else to do. So I kind of hung around on boats for a while, and I fell into the motion picture business and became an editor, which was perfect for me. If you can be, if you're any good at what I did, unfortunately I was, you can be eccentric, and you can be, you get locked in this little room by yourself, and you don't let people in while you're doing your work, so you can do all sorts of fun things in there, and not you know, and you know, I was doing, you know, a variety of things to keep my creative juices flowing. And, you know, there were times where I'd look at the clock. It's like 8:46 right now, and I'd look at the clock, and I wouldn't know if it was a.m. or p.m. because I'm locked in some little room doing my thing. And somehow putting out good work. I don't know how I became to do that. But, you know, it became a problem in the sense that it wasn't a problem for me. It was a problem for Vicky. And what she started doing was, unbeknownst to me, she started going to Al-Anon. Bummer. Yeah. And she was taking, oh, and a daughter came along in there too. I forgot to tell you that. A little daughter came in there. She was like 5 or 6, and she was taking her along to Alateen or Alatot or whatever they, I don't know what she was doing. She would, she'd take Sarah along with her, and, you know, what, it didn't immediately ruin my drinking. It ruined her sense of humor. I know that. She wasn't real, she became less fun. What can I say? You know, she just wasn't going with my gig anymore. And, I wasn't to find out later. It's pretty sad. I wasn't to find out later that my daughter, she would make sure that I didn't know about, you know, the father-daughter stuff, you know. She'd make sure I didn't know about the camping trips. She'd make sure I didn't know about, you know, meet the teacher night and stuff like that. And even sometimes on the way home from those Al-Anon meetings that she was being brought to, she'd spot a Best Western and tell her mom, why don't we stay there tonight? You know? I didn't know any of that stuff until later, and which I'm getting to. Vicky's not happy, and I'm still doing my thing. I had a few. I did finally go to an AA meeting somewhere along in there, and all that did was I stole a big book out of the deal because they said, you know, get a big book. So I did that, and it also, the only other thing it gave me was an excuse to go out. You know, I'd be telling Vicky, you know, I'm going to an AA meeting, and you know, don't wait up because they talk forever and they want to go to coffee and they want to talk and they want to talk some more and don't wait up for me, honey, you know. So that worked for, you know, probably a day, but it worked for a while. You know, and drinking became, you know, I got to the point where, you know, you kind of start out, you know, you drink for fun, you know, and then you drink. For me, it was you know, it took away the fear, you know, and then it became, I became afraid not to drink, you know. It turned on me, and you know, I sensed there was a problem, but I didn't do anything about it, you know. A couple of things that happened to me before I got sober, you know, I was in, as I said, I was in the film business, and what we were doing is we did anything but entertainment, if that makes sense. We did like shows for companies, commercials, you know, product films, whatever. And we had this really cool contract with, actually the best contract was with Budweiser, but I don't have time to get into that one. That was way cool. I'll tell you what it was a year contract with Budweiser going to all their, what they used to do is sponsor college parties, you know, and we'd go around and document the parties, for a year. And, they paid us to do that. Hello. And, I mean, is that a perfect job or not? You know, we went all the way from Hawaii to Bermuda to Oregon to Texas to Minnesota. We went all over the place. Got a few nicknames from that one. But, you know, one time when I was in the short crew thing, that means that there's like three of us would go out on a shoot. And we were working for the Suzuki company that does outboards, and we had to cover a fishing tournament. And, you know, in a short crew means that you got, you know, there's three guys, but you got to do a lot of stuff. And if one of you goes down, you're kind of in trouble, you know. So it was the night before we were supposed to shoot, and I got this funky feeling in my right side, you know. And it was kind of a funky pain. Then all of a sudden it started really hurting, and I'm lying in my bed. I'm going, God, I can't get sick. These guys are counting on me, man. And it got worse and worse and started, like, pulsating and weird shit. And I figured, you know, like the old days in the old West, I'd go down and get a bottle of scotch, and that would fix it. And that's what I did. I went down, got a bottle of scotch, and drank my way to sleep, and you know, somehow made it through the night and woke up not feeling really well, but I was able to do my job and move on. I wasn't find out till later, actually till when I got sober, was that I drank my way through a ruptured appendix. That's not normal drinking. You know what I mean? That's really not what a normal guy is going to do. Most guys would probably go to a doctor or at least check in with something like that. And I just didn't do that. And I ignored all the symptoms after the fact, which I won't go into. But there's many bodily things that happen to you when you do that. And I just ignored them. I just drank my way. You know, fortunately, I was getting close to being sober, and I didn't know at the time that's what I was getting close to. But apparently a ruptured appendix can kill you or something with some sort of, I don't know, infections or something like that. But I was drinking a lot of that. That's what they said. And then right before I got sober, I had my last car total accident. If you're new or if you've ever taken a solemn oath, this is a story about that. You know, I was in Chicago. We were doing a gig, and I borrowed a car. We were done with our thing, and I borrowed a car. And I went into town and got drunk on tequila. And I thought it was time to go home. Unfortunately, I blacked out somewhere along the line. And I'm cruising down the freeway, apparently. I'm blacked out. And all of a sudden, I come to right a split second before I'm going to T-bone concrete barriers that were being in place for the Robert F. Kennedy overpass that they were building. And I came to just in time to correct the car enough where it didn't T-bone the concrete, it kind of skidded, and I spun through this, overpass. And, I guess being late, the late hour, there wasn't a lot of cars, but I do remember kind of everything going slow motion and these cars whipping by, and I didn't hit anybody, thank God. I didn't kill anybody. I didn't hurt anybody. Hurt the car because it was ping-ponging back and forth from these concrete things. And in Chicago, they don't spend a lot of time reviewing accidents at 1:30 in the morning. But also prior to that, before the cops got there, some really nice guy came by and he stopped. And I'd gotten out of the car or something. And he said, "Are you okay?" I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "Whoa, man, you really smell bad. You smell like tequila. Here's a cigarette. I gotta go." So he takes off, and I don't smoke. So my best thinking is to eat the cigarette. Okay, so I don't know. Always thinking. Always thinking the right thing to do. Whatever. So the cops show up, and they show up with this tow truck with a big thing in the front. And they push this car off the side of the road to get the traffic moving. And I guess it's close to shift change. They don't want to do a lot with it. I think they're tired too, like my parents. One more. I'm probably obviously drunk, but I think I'm pulling it off enough because I'm in shock or something. I don't know. But typical. First of all, it's a rental. Big deal. Lincoln, but it's a Lincoln Town Car. It's a cool car. Cool car to total. My license, I didn't have a license. Shit, I didn't care about having a driver's license in those days. I'm 34 or something like that, but my license expired or whatever. So they decided, what the hell, we'll take you down to the station, get somebody down to pick you up before we go off, and we'll let you go for $100. I'm going, cool. Lucky. So I call up this guy, unfortunately it was his car I borrowed, and said, "Hey man, Frank, you got to come get me. Had a little accident. Need $100. And by the way, you needed a car." So Frank was cool. He came down and picked me up. And in the store, I got back to my room. It's like 2 o'clock. I got to get up in 4 or 5 hours to do my thing. My God of Catholic school came back to me, and Jesus and Hallelujah shit came to me, and I made a solemn prayer oath. Hand on the heart oath. Thank you, God, for saving my life tonight. I understand I'm never going to drink again. I swear, I swear, I swear. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And I get up in the morning. The first thing I do is go to the mini bar and have 2 Miller Lights for breakfast. Now, that's not normal drinking, man. That's not remembering what happened 4 hours earlier. That's just total bullshit alcoholism. The only funny part about that thing was that I thought it was kind of funny. When we turned the cars back in, we had started out with 8 cars, and we turned in 7 and a set of keys. And I'll never forget the little lady's face when she goes, "Oh, okay, yeah." She's doing the paperwork, and here's the keys to this one. "Oh, where is that?" And, you know, 424 Smith Street. I don't know where the hell it is. Whatever. "See ya." She goes, "Wait, that's the wrecking yard." You know, "Thank you. Goodbye. Wait, wait." It's a rental. So, what can I say? So, somewhere along the line, okay, something happened. And it became apparent that Vicki wasn't happy. And you know, somewhere it became serious. And what happened was I was late one more time for one of my daughter's soccer games. And I was going to reason with Vicki one more time. And she chased, you know, we were doing this thing around this tree, you know, like she didn't want to talk to me. She didn't want to see me. She didn't want to have anything to do with me. It was kind of like, you know, "Wait a minute, I got to talk to you." "Uh-huh." You know, doing that thing, going around, "Just fuck you," you know. Anyway, I finally got her, and we finally stopped. And I saw a look in her eyes I never want to see again. And guys, if you've ever seen this look, I hope you don't ever want to see it again either. I saw the look of a broken woman. You know, her spirit had been broken. Her heart had been broken. She was busted, man, and I broke her, and I was bummed, and it hit me. And you know, she said something like, "You're out of here, you're done," and I fully expected that, whatever. I don't remember much. I was more hit by the pain of the hurt that I had caused. It was really weird, you know. I think I kind of left or something along there, and it's kind of foggy, you know. In those days, actually, my 20s were kind of foggy, and I'm 33 or 34 right about now, and it's time to get sober. That's good. So what happened was I took her seriously in the sense that maybe I'm just stressed out, maybe I need a break. So what I did is I went down to see a psychiatrist friend who was happened to be a friend of my father's. They were lifelong buddies, and he had come down to Orange County here, and he was kind of the leader, kind of one of the leading guys in starting rehab, you know, looking at doctor shit and around this area. And he had a place called Capistrano by the Sea, up off Del Obispo, and it's no longer there. But I went to see him, and he talked me into he listened to my tale of woe, and you know, you probably need a break. Sounds like you need a little bit of a break. Why don't you come to this place for a couple of weeks? A 2-week short stay. And which turned into a lot longer than that. And it really wasn't a vacation. It was a nut ward, basically. And, the first place I woke up was in some green room with no door handles. And, you know, it was pretty gnarly. And he fooled me, you know. He saved my life, but he sure fooled me, you know. I signed up for 2 weeks, and I was in there a lot longer than that. But what's going on with my life at this time? Something's happening, you know. Something's happening, you know. And what happened specifically there was I'm in this detox room, and I'm really not feeling well, and I'm shaking. And this other guy walks in, and some of you know him. His name is Ken D. And he walks into this room, and he's looks worse than I feel. He's shaking like a leaf, and he's coming off other stuff, and he just looks horrible. But he had been there longer than I had, and he's shaking, bakes his way into my room, and he says, "You know what? This thing's going to work, and you never have to drink again if you don't want to." And there's absolutely no reason on the face of the earth that I should believe this guy, give him any credence at all. And for some reason, the stars lined up or something happened where I was just at that moment willing to listen to this guy and actually believed him. And for some reason, and again, God, he's not the guy you look at and go, "I'm going to take advice from this guy," you know. I believed him. Something happened. And he and I have been doing this thing together now for 23 plus years. You know, he stayed sober. I've stayed sober. And if you're new, I suggest... a little offshoot, I suggest that instead of, as well as getting a sponsor, try and hook up with some people that have the same amount of time you have. Because with Ken and I, it's been kind of a fun thing to do this 23-year-long voyage together. You know, we just kind of we've stayed together. And another thing, you know, along those lines, if you're new, look around this room. You know, it's a really diverse group of people. You know, there's young, old, different stuff. And I just got to tell you, the reason I bring that up is alcohol doesn't really give a shit who you are. Alcohol will care, doesn't care, has no respect. It will take you down no matter who you are. You know, young, old, female, male, whatever else there is. I don't know. I don't want to offend anybody. Politically correct, whatever. But whatever you are, it doesn't care. It doesn't care how old you are or how much you drink. It'll take you down no matter what. It will kill you. It will kill you. But, you know, so far, through the grace of God, I've had 23 extra years of life. You know, I started doing the stuff that people suggest to do, you know. I was forced to for the first, however long I was in that place. It's funny, real quick, also this doctor, his name is Tony Sturdivant, he's passed away now, but he's probably the guy that really saved my life. He had known me my whole life. He knew me when I was a twinkle in my dad's eye. You know what I mean? I mean, he knew me my whole life. And a couple, you know, maybe, I don't know, a year after I got sober and stayed sober or whatever we're talking, and he told me, he said, you know, I knew you'd be here when you were 3 years old. You know? So whatever that means, I thought I was kind of blown away. It was interesting to me that he was saving me a seat then. So, you know, for me, sobriety, you know, time to get sober. Sober's been a good thing. I think when I did get sober, I did what people suggested I do. I got a sponsor. I got a sponsor at 60 days. I get a dry throat when I tell the truth. I did what I was supposed to do. I got a sponsor at 60 days. I still have the same sponsor today. I talked to him today. I still talk to him almost every other day. The only time we don't talk is if he's on a trip or I'm out of town or whatever. We still hang out together, or, you know, still do the deal. My problems are different today than they were when I was getting new, or when I was new, obviously. There's a lot less whining on my part. But he's there when I want to whine too, you know. You can still have crappy days of 23-year sobriety, and some days I call him and he's having a crappy day and I help him. So it's a wee deal, you know. We do this thing together. I found a higher power in this deal, and I've also found he kind of knows who I am, and he knew, I think, when I got sober that I needed a burning bush situation for me to get some sort of faith or some sort of exposure to some sort of idea that there might be something greater than I out there. And, you know, and I think what he decided to do was that when I was 90 days sober, I got diagnosed with this humongous tumor in my gut, kind of around where my appendix was, used to be. And, you know, it was one of those deals where, I started feeling this funny feeling in my side again, and you know, I went, had my dad feel it out. He said, you know, he wasn't sure. Go to this guy over here. You know, go to see my friend, this guy. He does this, and if you do a time frame, like on a Monday, they did a ultrasound, and this girl's doing this thing on my stomach, and she's doing this thing. All of a sudden, her eyes kind of go whoa, and I see her do that, and I go, what's up? She goes, nothing. Yeah, everything's fine, but I'll be right back. So she goes and gets this guy who looks like Omar Gaddafi with all these ribbons on his thing, like head of department. You know, I'm the chief dude. You know, I'm the whatever guy. You know, and he's going, check this out, isn't this cool? And he kind of goes, oh, and I go, what's up? And you know, I said, what's going on? You know, and they go, oh no, we're just checking. It's a really good image. Whatever. And I said, well, when's my doctor going to know the results of this thing? And they say, a couple of days. No worries. No problem. That's on Monday. Monday afternoon, I get a call. You got to come take a thing where they put barium up you and do a, it's not pleasant. I don't even want to say the word. But they do, but I'll see it. Barium enema. Doesn't that sound fun? Tomorrow, you got to take a barium enema tomorrow on Tuesday. So something's really happening, and I do the same drill. They push this stuff into me, and it's not pleasant. And I say, well, when is Dr. Schmo going to hear about this test? Oh, it takes a couple of days. I get home, get to the office, and get back to do something. And the doctor calls and says, why don't you and your wife come in and have a chat tonight? You don't want a call like that from a doctor. So we go in, and, you know, it's on a Wednesday. I get the scope on Thursday, and they're cutting me on Friday. It went that fast. They said, we got to get this thing out of there. And it turned out to be a rather large, it's called a venous adenoma, whatever, and it was wrapped around my colon, my intestines, and attaching itself to my stomach and some other important parts of your body that you can't live without. And so they went in there, and they did the best they could back in 87, which is, you know, rusty saws and a few, you know, scissors, and, you know, and I got a scar like this, and now they do it with a little pinprick probably, but... No, they did the best they could. What can I tell you? You know, and my sponsor gave me some good advice. He says, you know, don't pray for yourself, don't pray for results, pray that the doctor has a good day. You know what I mean? That's what I did. And, you know, apparently they did. They got it all, and it turned out okay. And but they told me one thing. They said, came in a couple of days after I was kind of coming out of this thing. It was rather painful. I was coming out of this thing on... They started talking to me. This is where I found out about the ruptured appendix. They asked me, they said, you remember having any pain in your side like a couple months ago? And I said, yeah, back in June or something like that, you know. And they go, well, yeah, it was a ruptured appendix, you know. That's not a good thing to do that. And, okay. They knew I'd stopped drinking. They knew that I'd been sober 90 days. And they said another thing. It says, you know, what you did when you stopped drinking is you started feeling what was going on with your body and stuff like that. You know, after 30, 60, 90 days or so, you still, you know, that's why you felt this thing. You know, you probably ignored some of the symptoms of this thing. You probably ignored some of the problems you would have had with a ruptured appendix, blah, 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 but you got sober. And, you know, if you didn't get sober, you probably wouldn't have this thing checked out, and you probably wouldn't be laying on that bed right now. But we got to tell you that about 2 months from now, if you would have come to see us, we would have opened you up, sent you home to die. You're that close to dying, you little shit. And, you know, that's kind of a message. You know what I mean? I got sober just in time to save my life from something that was going to kill me without me knowing it. And God got my attention. And, you know, from then on, you know, it's been interesting. I've been lucky to stay sober, you know, in the sense that I've done everything I've been asked to do. I guess it's not luck. You know, I don't know what it's called. Something happened. I can't tell you what. But, you know, I've done everything I'm supposed to do, and what's happened is, you know, the first couple of years, I did everything I could possibly do to, I wanted to be, I don't know if anybody's like me, but I want to be the best, you know, or I'm number one, or whatever, you know, so I want to be the best sponsee in the world, you know, and RV got a little tired of that. So after about doing a year of 14 meetings, he suggested that since I had a family that I could maybe cut back a little bit. Which I thought was cool. You know, this guy, I like this guy. You know, he understands. And so what I got to do is I got started spending time with my wife and started going to more father-daughter dances than I'd ever dreamed I could go to because my daughter wanted me to go. You know what I mean? She wouldn't let me forget. She'd tell me a month ahead of time, we got a camp out coming up. We got a dance coming up. And I had to learn a square dance with this kid, you know? And, you know, it was cool. You know, and I'm sweating out there and I'm an idiot. But, to see the smile on her face and, then I didn't find out till later that she didn't want to be with me, you know, up until then. She didn't want to see me when I was drunk. She didn't want me to know about anything. That's a trip, you know what I mean? To have her go from that to, hey, don't forget, 2 months from now, we're going square dancing. Yes, dear. Don't let me forget it every day. And she's turned out to be a wonderful child. You know what I mean? She's made me a grandfather in this program. You know, by being sober, she made me a father-in-law. I got to walk her down the aisle to some guy that loves her as much as I do, and she actually asked me to do it. You know what I mean? And she was proud to have me there. That's a cool deal. She's pregnant now. She's gonna make me a grandfather again. So I'll have a granddaughter and a grandson pretty soon. Also out of the deal, I got a sober daughter, who was born, I don't know, like I said, the first 2 years was difficult. I was going to get a divorce in the first 2 years. After about 2 years, I was time to get a divorce. I didn't tell Vicki that, but, it was clear in my mind it was time to get a divorce. And, what happened was, and, don't tell her this. What happened was it was really, things weren't going well, you know. It just wasn't happening, you know. Me trying to get, you know, stay sober, and we weren't peaking at that time. And I became willing to let this marriage go if that was God's will. And I remember saying a silly prayer, going, you know, if this thing isn't supposed to work, I'm okay with that. It hurt to say it, and I'm not sure I meant it, but I did say it. And immediately things got better. I don't know how that works. But as soon as I was willing to let that thing go, the better it got. And it must have been some magic that this whole program is, but some magic happened, and we became, all of a sudden we started working together, and I don't know what happened. Out of that whole thing, I got another daughter out of the deal, who just turned 21. She's never seen me drink. Being a father and being, you know, taught by a lot of guys in this room how to be a father is a big deal. I spoke the other night, and some guy said, "Oh, you sure talk about your family a lot." I said, "Well, yeah, sorry about that. That's important to me. If you don't have a family, that's your problem, not mine." I mean no disrespect. But I speak about my family because it's a blessing of this program to be able to be a father and a husband and things like that, in my case, you know. And I'm not dissing not having family, but it's something that's made my life full. And, these kids going to school, it was fun to watch. I was able not to miss a game. You know, my daughter played volleyball. My oldest played volleyball. I never missed a game. My youngest played softball. I never missed a game. You know, and every so often, you know, they even say, "Hey, thanks for coming to the game." You know, and my youngest one time, she was a pretty good softball player, and it was one of these travel ball. I mean, when you're good at a sport now in high school, you got to play like year round. It's become a factory is what it's become. It's really absurd, but you play year round the sport, so you can't have any other fun. But anyway, that's what she wanted to do, and she was playing on this travel team. She's traveling around. And we were out in somewhere that I don't want to be, and but I'm digging it, man. I mean, we drive, you know, we get up at 5 in the morning and drive places. It was so cool. It was our time. It was our time together. Dave Matthews, and here we go. Kind of dates me there. There's just one game. I'll never forget it. You know, it's the last game of the day. They're down 2 runs. You know, I might embellish because it sounds cool, but as I remembered, they were 2 runs down. And she was coming up, and there was 2 on base, and toward the end of the game, and I was going to go up and give her some hitting advice, which is stupid. You know, what am I going to tell this kid, you know? So I walk up there, and I go, "Hey," you know, and she goes, and all I could say, you know, it happened to be my sober birthday. It happened to be September 16th, the day we were playing. Okay, and I'm not sure what year it was, 5 years ago, so maybe 18, 19, something like that. And so I walk up to her, and I just go, all I say to her is, "Remember what day it is?" And she looks at me, and she goes, "Yeah, I know it's your birthday, you know, big deal." So she gets up there, man, and she swings at that first pitch. And she friggin' launches that ball. They're still chasing that ball. And she smacked the heck out of that leather and just took it for a ride. The left fielder literally just stood there, just, "I ain't gonna chase that thing," you know. So she's doing the deal, and then the kids are all excited. It's great, man. And it's getting time where she's at home base and home plate, and they're 5-5, and man, and the team's all this stuff. And I'm looking down there, and I'm just going, "God, that's so great." And everything all of a sudden slowed down, you know. Went in slow motion, and she just did this slow turn and looked up at me and just kind of gave me a "what's up." You know, just kind of gave me a little nod, eye contact, you know, and back to her friends. It took about 10 minutes for me. It probably lasted about a half a second. But I'll never forget it. And that's something that happens, you know. It doesn't happen to a guy like me. It doesn't happen to a guy who's crashing cars, who's drinking his way over through a ruptured appendix. You know, it doesn't happen to a guy who's broken his wife. You know, you don't get to see your kid hit a home run. It just happens to be your birthday and give you a wink saying that's for you. You know, it doesn't happen to guys like us. And it happened for me. You know, since I've been sober, I'm still married to Vicky. We're still doing the deal. She's always wanted to move to San Clemente. We just recently, like I said, we moved down here in June. Kids are, you know, we're empty nesters or whatever that's called. So we bought a house down here finally where Vicky's wanted to move. We brought our kids up in Irvine. I have no problem with that. They're good kids, and both went to school and was able to offer, you know, when my oldest daughter, like I mentioned, she made me a grandfather. She got knocked up is what she did. And, you know, she was, but, you know, the cool part about it was that she was able to call us and tell us that and know probably in her heart that we weren't going to turn her back or whatever. She needed a place to come home to. She needed a safe place to be pregnant and get rid of this loser that knocked her up. But it wasn't that guy. Come back. Not you. Close to home. Anyway. So, you know, that's pretty cool. You know, we were able to give her a place, a safe place to stay and get pregnant. And eventually she married this great guy. And that's been a blessing. And to be able to do that for your kids is something else, you know, to be able to do that kind of stuff. What I do for this program and what I do because of sobriety is, you know, I have never lost touch with the program. I've never tried to do it different. I thank God for that. Maybe it was getting saved from that tumor. I don't know. Whatever happened to me was I became willing to give this thing my best shot. You know, and I don't know, perfect and all that stuff. But what it's done is it's taken me off the sidelines and got me in the game. You know, I got a shot to do anything I want to today. You know, as long as I decide in the morning that I'm not going to drink this day. You know what I mean? And you know, that's true for everybody. And what I've been able to do is stay married, be a father, and move my wife down to San Clemente where she's already wanted to move down to. So, you know, by doing the simple things, and if you're new or not new or whatever, or you're having a problem, you know, what worked and is working for me is that I still talk to my sponsor, as I mentioned. We still run shit by each other. And, you know, I read the book. He and I are going through the book again, reading different stuff out of the book. I do things like this when I'm asked. You know, I'm not a circuit speaker by any means, but I do speak when I'm asked to. I also sponsor guys. There's guys in this room that I sponsor, which is way cool. And try to speak slow tonight because they're here. no disrespect. They've kept me sober. And I'm also, so what that means to me is, you know, I sponsor and I'm sponsored. NRB is a sponsor. So I'm, you know, the way I look at it, I'm right in the middle of AA, man. You know what I mean? I'm right in the middle and that's where it's safe. And I'm in the middle of this deal and, you know, I'm really grateful for this deal. I don't run out of shit to say. So, so we're not going to go over tonight, I can tell you that. You know, if you're new, and again, I want to applaud Brittany for having the guts to lead a meeting when she's new. And I want to say thank you to, what's his name?
Jordan.
Yeah, Jordan. Thanks, Jordan, for asking me to speak. And I'm going to end it short tonight because I got nothing else to say, but I'm grateful to be here and I'm grateful to be sober. And I appreciate you all listening. Thank you.